ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When was the last time you really looked at your kettle, your umbrella, the hallway mirror, or even a gravestone? Every one of them was designed by someone for a reason. And those choices are still shaping how you live. The ordinary isn't ordinary at all. That's By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Find it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, well, Lee, before we get started, a very important question. Are we saying football or soccer?
Oh, well, the Pope has just said soccer. I don't know that I could have a fight with His Holiness, Hamish, so maybe we'll go with that.
Well, Lee v Pope, I'm not sure. Can we still call it the beautiful game, this World Cup?
We have to. It's always beautiful, especially when Australia is scoring unlikely wins.
I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Waleed Ali, and on today's Global Roaming, will America get the World Cup's first red card?
So, Waleed, I'm totally in your hands for this episode. There are many things in which I am less well prepared than you on and less researched, but this is absolutely one of them. But before we get into it, are you going at all? Yeah, I know you know, very often I've filled in for you on various programs because you're going to a football match somewhere in the world.
That is true. I've never been to a World Cup, though. The club game is very much my focus. I'm a very big Liverpool fan and so on. But the World Cup has a certain magic to it in the way that I guess the Olympics do and things like that. And frankly, we saw that, didn't we, over the weekend? I mean, Australia's win over Turkey and that goal from Nestori Erankunda, this incredible talent that's emerged out of Adelaide, an African refugee, one of a couple in the team. Well, there is something about that moment that galvanises a nation and pulls at the heartstrings in a way that so few things do in life. So I'm always under the World Cup spell, even if I don't think to go before it begins. It's weird.
And in a strange enough way, Waleed, I think Nestori Erankunda, his story, that goal, our win over Turkey, sort of sets up and frames the conversation we're going to have on this episode perfectly, because the man that we're going to meet is kind of a master at helping us understand the threads between the politics, the people and the game in a way that already people are observing about Nestori Erankunda, in the week that Pauline Hanson emerges as the preferred prime minister in the polls, one nation leapfrogs the other political parties. Here we have this team made up of many immigrant backgrounds, someone that came to Australia as a refugee on a broadcaster, SBS, that One Nation is not always particularly partial to the funding of. It's kind of that goes to the discussion we're having today.
Yeah, it's this weird thing about sport, isn't it, that it is political at the same time as it is not. And in some ways it's political precisely because it's not. It allows you to have conversations by proxy you could never have directly as a political conversation, because they're infused by, I don't know, is it too much to say, a common object of love? This thing that goes to our hearts in a way before it goes to our brains. I'm really excited about this guest because there's probably no better vehicle for embodying all the wild forces and contradictions of the world than the World Game. The combination of national identities and migration within those nations, but then also, and especially in the club game, just the wild, untrammeled dominance of money. All sorts of crazy things happen. Nation states buying clubs because they want to establish their soft power and have limitless budgets. All these things just go on and on and on. And so you could basically do an entire discussion of the world simply through this sport. And so the World Cup becomes, I guess, the apex of that sort of conversation, an easy way to have it, especially on a show like this.
I often think cricket writing in Australia and in the UK is among the best sports writing in the world, but actually probably it is football writing. And the man that we're about to speak to is described as the greatest sports writer of the 21st century. His name is David Goldblatt. He's a sociologist, journalist, author. He wrote a history called The Ball is Round, and his latest book, Injury Time in a State of Emergency, was voted the best sports book of 2025 by The New Statesman. He's going to help us explore all of this. Here he is now.
David, welcome to Global Roaming.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, What a start the World Cup's had, especially if you're an Australian. But enough about that. Let's talk about the event itself, because it's fair to say there was a fair bit of speculation about how we would go with the United States holding a World Cup. That's, I don't know, how do we call it? America first? And where it's certain other nations not first and not even being able to get into the country. How would you say it's going?
Well, as Deng Xiaoping said of the French Revolution, it is too early to say. This goes on for 5.5 weeks. So I think so far, some of the things that we thought would be the case are the case. There are some quite a lot of empty seats. I thought it was interesting, the Mexico City game, on the one hand, completely extraordinary atmosphere, amazing rebuild of the stadium. So some of the expectations, you know, of how this tournament will play out are happening. On the other hand, you know, we're also all enjoying the football.
David, sometimes the anxiety leading up to these big events can not quite deliver in terms of the disastrous event that people are anticipating. You know, I think we can all remember the Sydney Olympics. Everyone was saying we can never pull it off. It'll never go to plan. I'm even thinking back to the Russia World Cup, the Qatar-hosted World Cup. Obviously, there were some things that went wrong, but by and large, the World Game did bring people together. It did kind of work. They managed to deliver. Do you think that could happen here?
Well, I'm just going to sort of push you a little on Russia as a success. I mean, what is the criteria? You know, if we're saying the World Cup should be a Potemkin village that disguises the authoritarian cruelty of a regime by putting up a farcical imaginary version of the nation in public spaces while the media is there, then Russia was an absolute stonking success. You know, on the other hand, that was precisely the critique that was made of it beforehand. So I just slightly caution that. I mean, I think the World Cup delivers many, many things. And I think that we will have moments of beauty and resistance and unpredictability, underdogs, you know, doing amazingly incredible players that most of us have never heard of. And of course, this will fill the space. And that's the purpose of the exercise in the end, is, you know, a global festival of human creativity and spontaneity. But I will be surprised if all of the critiques and all of the concerns entirely disappear. Let's see what the stadiums look like over the next few weeks. You know, let's see what the consequences of an average price of $2,000 a ticket does to the atmosphere. Let's see what the orange man himself decides to do. I thought it was interesting that the US, you know, won their opening game. Fantastic. Beat Paraguay 4-1. Not a word from Mar-el Lago. I mean, maybe we should be pleased, but there's more to come.
No, David, he's keeping a lid on it. It's very important you don't get carried away with early tournament form, David. You know this as well as anybody. And I think Donald Trump's being very sensible in that regard. But behind the football, ridiculous things are happening. We've seen a refugee not be allowed into the United States, denied a visa, Africa's best referee, who's, I think, being given the compensation of being promised a referee the European Super Cup later on. You have the situation of Iran having to fly into the United States from Mexico because they're not allowed to sleep in the United States. They have to fly in, clear immigration, play a game, fly back out to Mexico. I mean, these are ridiculous circumstances for any team to be playing a major tournament. If they were, you know, a team that was fancied to perhaps win the World Cup or do well in the World Cup, this would be an utter scandal.
Yeah, it's a disgrace. On the other hand, one way of reframing it is to say if one of the functions of football and the World Cup is to show the world as it is, to be a mirror of our world to us, then I think this is demonstrating the experience of particularly people of colour at the US border in a really powerful way. In a way, I would say that most white folks who don't think it applies to them actually have to look it in the face. I mean, similarly, did you see the way the Uzbek and the Senegalese teams were treated when they showed up? Basically, yeah, like they're a bunch exactly. of drug dealers. That's how they were treated. So while on the one hand it's really ugly, on the other hand I say, well, this is how America is at the moment. Look it in the face. This is how it is.
I mean, I think that's probably fair, although I wouldn't accuse the world of not looking America in the face at the moment. It's getting a lot of attention. I suppose the question I have is, you know, very often when there are major sporting events, Olympics, World Cups, whatever, there's angst about, is this nation fit to host it? What about the human rights record, et cetera, et cetera? I will confess, and maybe this is just me, I'm not terribly moved by a lot of those sorts of objections because they are world events and you take the world as you find it. But I do think there is one prerequisite that perhaps should exist for a host, and that is that they let the participants in to play the sport, to do the relevant event. Is there much concern, consternation, much questioning of America's fitness as a host for this event? Not because of whether we like Donald Trump or what it's doing around the world or whatever, but just because of the function of hosting the actual event and whether or not it's compatible with what it's doing.
For sure. I mean, if I was organizing any kind of sporting world championship, I would be very concerned about holding it in the United States at the moment. I mean, we only have 48 teams at the World Cup, of whom, you know, four are countries where you really can't get a visa, and another 12, 14, it's very difficult. But if you're holding the Olympics or some sort of more broader global event, then you're going to be looking at dozens and dozens and dozens of national delegations, athletes and so on, who will face the same problem. So it would definitely give me, you know, it would give one pause for thought.
David, I wonder if you could explain for listeners a brief version of your thesis in Injury Time, where you talk about how football provides this sort of perfect vantage point for the crises, the polycrises, as you describe it, that the UK and Europe are living through. Because I then want to ask you whether or not a similar lens can be applied now for this World Cup and the global context.
So I sort of set myself the task in Injury Time of trying to write the history of Britain of the last 10, 15 years, which have been the most tumultuous, certainly I have ever lived through, though I suspect the next 10 or 15 will be much worse. And it's been austerity, it's been Brexit, it's been growing inequality. There's been a mental health crisis, we've had COVID, we've had a climate crisis. It's like all over the place. And I wondered whether football would allow me to carry that narrative in an interesting way. And I think I would say, amazingly, football has become so capacious and such a mainstream part of cultural life and reaches so many demographics in so many ways and is in a way not merely just a reflection anymore of politics and society, but an active transformer of it. Then, yeah, it becomes a really extraordinary space to explore that. And I think this is particularly relevant to the World Cup. You know, football functions as a form of public theatre. You know, it puts on show stuff that is normally hidden and creates a space through the crowd and the voices around football for the public to be actually chorus and commentator. And that's actually quite rare in public life. I mean, just to give you one tiny example, at the end of COVID, when the Euros took place in 2021, the England national team were taking the knee as a protest against racism in football and the world. 20% of the England crowd boos them because 20% of the England crowd, basically the country, are far right and quite racist. And eventually 80% of the crowd, after scratching their head and feeling embarrassed, clapped and applauded and drowned out the booers. And I can't imagine a sort of more incredible public display of the sort of divisions and demography of the politics of ethnicity in Britain than, bang, there on the football pitch. So that's my thesis.
Yeah, I thought your references to things like Gary Lineker's tweets or even the arrival of Russian money or money from the Arab Gulf in the UK economy and how that filtered its way through into football, I found that stuff really fascinating because I think, as you point out, sometimes, particularly when it comes to that sort of money and wealth, it's not as obvious, it's not as apparent in a way that we can really understand.
No, I mean, people, you know, it makes tangible a much bigger process. You know, the British economy has been absolutely eaten by American private equity, by foreign oligarchs and foreign states depositing their slightly dodgy money to be laundered through the City of London. And that's all invisible to most people most of the time. But it's very tangible when you look at who owns the Premier League these days. You know, I think we're down to three domestic owners, one of whom is a tax-dodging tax exile, and the rest are foreign oligarchs or indeed state projects. And that's how the British economy is working, let alone just the Premier League.
You're listening to Global Roaming and our chat with football writer and author David Goldblatt. There are all sorts of tensions in what you describe there. I mean, I guess this firms your thesis, doesn't it? I remember when the taking of the knee started happening in the Premier League and you had players that started refusing to do it, including some black players over it. All these debates sort of started to play out. But then I think about, you know, one of the contradictions of modern Britain that emerged over the past season, I think, with Manchester United's owner, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, you know, this British billionaire who made comments about Britain being colonised by migrants, I think was his phrase, while then taking his seat to watch a team stacked with non-English players, including a lot of black ones.
75% of the Premier League, and this is what makes the Premier League one of the reasons, is this concentration of global talent and access to markets all over the world. I mean, also look at the England team. You know, the England team is made by migration. I mean, I did a little count of this, and I would say for players of colour who are either migrants themselves or are the children of migrants, it's 16 out of 26. Declan Rice and Harry Kane have got Irish roots. That's 18 out of 26. Without migration, there is no England team. Oh, and I note the coach is from Germany.
Yeah, that's right. I remember there was a bit of consternation when he was appointed too because of that fact. But then you don't have to stop at England. The French team, you know, routinely full of stars whose heritage goes back to the colonies.
22 out of 26.
Yeah, and then you get the reverse effect. The Moroccan team, a lot of French-based players or players who were born in Europe who are now getting in touch with their Moroccan heritage and playing extraordinary football for their country of origin, I suppose.
I mean, this is the reality of the modern world, is that there are diasporas everywhere. The same is true of the Bosnians. Most of the Bosnian players were not born in Bosnia. Most of the Croats weren't born in Croatia. You know, most of the Congolese, 80%, I think, are from the diaspora. I often think, you know, this is an opportunity to celebrate what's great about migration. You know, a lot of people take the opportunity, particularly on the right and populists and nativists, to have a go here. But I look and say, this is what makes migration great. Fusion, development, transformation, hope, and a space, unlike most of British society, indeed many host societies, where the talent and the graft of migrants is recognised and rewarded.
Is it though, David? That's my question. Was it Karim Benzema, the great French striker, who said, I'm an Arab when I don't play well and when we lose, and I'm French when we win? We mentioned Jim Ratcliffe. He literally owns Manchester, one of the owners of Manchester United, in a country where reform is surging and now being outflanked by Restore Britain even further right. There is something interesting that happens in the World Cup because it's a nationalist affair. And even if they are migrants on the pitch, Australia has just seen this. You know, a couple of African refugees playing up top for Australia, and one of them scores one of the great goals in Australia's, albeit limited, World Cup history, and yet one nation is surging. I just wonder whether or not the story you're telling is the story people see.
Well, I just think there's a fight on, isn't there? There are different versions of the nation, and we disagree. And people like Ratcliffe and people like Reform and people like One Nation have their ludicrous nativist ethnic version, which, of course, is a complete and utter historical fantasy. The idea that there has been ethnic purity anywhere ever is just absurd. And what we actually see is a civic version of the nation. Some people don't like it, but there's a fight on. And that's what I love for myself about the England national team, is that it's impossible for the Reform and the Restore folks to take any pleasure or succour from the successes of this team. Because you cannot imagine, you look at the England national team and it's like Englishness and whiteness, this no longer, makes any sense. This is not the lived reality. It's not what people really feel. And sure, the racists have got a problem with it. Like, what are you going to do? Of course. But we're not going to take them seriously or take this lying down.
So if what you're saying is correct, David, and we can all see that globally there is this sort of trend against globalization, if the fight is on, does this World Cup crystallize any of those arguments? Does it settle any of those arguments?
Well,
or does it flame them, flare them?
It depends how you want to sort of, you know, frame it. The Economist had a really interesting article this week on the World Cup where they tried to say, you know, what are the factors that determine whether you're going to win the World Cup or not, how well you do? And it's like about GDP and it's about depth of football tradition, obviously about population size. But they found the most powerful correlate was degree of diversity. That is one of the great sources of success in football. And I would be very surprised if any team who wins this is not actually a very diverse team. Even Spain, which, you know, until recently, you might argue pretty monocultural. Five or six of the players now, including the star, a Sierra Leonean Gambian Spaniard of Muslim faith, but a Spaniard. And he's the star. So I think that's one in the eye for the nativists and for the people that think there is some sort of crude ethnic national essence that is represented in football. You know, what makes for great football, you know, is diversity and mixture and experiment.
What makes for a great tournament, apart from the stuff that happens on the grass, is what's happening in the stands, the colour, the fans, and so on. You mentioned very briefly some empty seats and you mentioned an elite crowd in Mexico. I note that this has been an extraordinary World Cup for FIFA, just extracting money from ticket pricing, surge pricing, resale, where they get a cut out of every resale that goes on, tickets going on sale for thousands of dollars when they were meant to be much cheaper than that. Zohran Mamdani, I think, trying to reserve tickets in New York for local New Yorkers and so on. I just wonder whether or not there's something about the World Cup soul that is different here because of all of that.
Yeah, I really unambiguously agree with you on that. I mean, FIFA just decided to increase the ticket prices relative to Qatar four times before we even got to dynamic pricing and extra categories and all of that stuff. They just decided to increase it virtually four times over. And I think that's a problem. The World Cup doesn't just happen in the stadiums. It's really important what's happening in collective viewing spaces all around the world and in the host cities. But it also matters what's going on inside the stadiums. And I just think it's taking the mickey.
Quick final thought. How far do the Socceroos get? Who's in the final, please, David?
The Socceroos, you know, honest guys, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning here. So I had to do the highlights. Great to see it. Can't see any reason why they can't get out of their group. And then who knows?
Anyway, we've spoken too much football. I think Hamish is asleep, David. So I'll just say thank you so much for speaking to us. I'd love to keep going, but apparently time's finite on this show. Really appreciate your time.
It's been a real pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
That was David Goldblatt. He is the author of The Ball is Round, A Global History of Football. His most recent book, Injury Time, Football in the State of Emergency. Waleed, I suspect you could have talked to him all day, maybe even all week, about how this World Cup will unfold on the pitch. But what about the politics of it?
Yeah, I noticed you didn't want to give a tip there, Hamish, and I'm going to make sure you give one by the end of the show. Look, we are very complicated as a species, aren't we? And everything we do, and this shows up, I think, especially in major sporting events, the Olympics, World Cup and so on, embodies so many of those contradictions. And I think David observed some of those, this sort of mix of cosmopolitanism and nationalism that seems that probably nothing embodies as well as the World Cup and just the world game. I often wonder about how many Remain voters, for example, are attending all these Premier League matches and screaming for their heroes who are not remotely English in any way, shape or form. So those sort of things are there. This is a very weird moment though. And there is something I think singular about the nature of Trump's America hosting this World Cup. And something about the way in which it's not just that sport becomes a theatre for politics, but politics comes to compromise the actual sport. Apart from boycotts and things like that and Olympics, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that.
Mm. The thing I was reflecting on in the conversation with David, though, was the contrast or the reference point of Qatar and Russia hosting. Even if you disagree totally with them doing it, even if you say it was all just a terrible, you know, dressing up of some rather difficult and problematic things going on in those countries, those countries were hosting it in part as a soft power exercise, right? Yeah. They were trying to, I guess, upgrade their brand in the eyes of the world. What strikes me about this World Cup being mostly hosted in the United States is that Trump and his administration don't seem particularly interested in using it for that purpose. In fact, they seem to be wanting to send a different message about what America is. And it is this very hard, tough line interaction with the world that we're seeing play out in so many different political and geopolitical arenas. They're saying they want to display that now in the way that they deal with visa holders coming in to represent other countries or a referee from Somalia or all the rest that that you've listed. They're not seeing this as a mechanism to soften some of the harder edge stuff that the United States is doing. In fact, they seem to be using it almost as another vector for displaying that worldview.
Yeah, I guess that's consistent with the MAGA worldview, isn't it, which is not about soft power, conspicuously not about soft power. It is a hard power politics. We will achieve things through leverage, tariffs, perhaps military intervention where necessary and perhaps even when not necessary. But it is about the expression of power, not the expression of persuasion or cajoling or anything like that. And so then the messages become more or less domestic, don't they? We'll see how it plays out over the course of the tournament. But the sort of the specter that's been spoken about of ICE agents moving into police, illegal immigrants or even fans who are turning up to games because that's where they might be. Now, we saw that threat, by the way, in the Club World Cup, which happened a year ago, also in the United States. And so you had clubs from all over the world coming to play in this tournament, and you had the same threat. Now, it didn't really eventuate in that case, but the language was always there. That said, we did see on that occasion Trump got very involved in the celebrations at the final when Chelsea won that tournament. He wanted to be up on the stage. He was front and center. I don't know if he'll do the same again, but that has the internet buzzing over the prospect of Donald Trump having to hand over the World Cup to the victors, Iran. I don't know if either of those elements are going to happen, but imagine if it did.
you want my forecast, Waleed. The thing is, living in the UK for as long as I did, you just saw how the temperament of the Germans always seemed to work in these long and drawn out tournaments. Now, I'm not saying the Germans, but I reckon it is that slightly slower, more crafted temperament that might work well in what is almost certainly going to be a fairly raucous, fractious period of weeks. That's how I'll lean with no other insight into the footballing
capacity of these
teams. So the temperament.
Yeah, cultural temperament is the way in which this works. I mean, World Cups are funny things and funny things happen. And there is always a bolter. There is always one nation that seems to go further than anyone expected. Morocco was it last time. They look really good again. We saw South Korea do it. We've seen Turkey do it. Maybe it's Australia, Hamish.
Maybe it's the Socceroos.
We might be the only soccer World Cup semi-finalist ever that needs the game explained to its fans.
global.roaming@abc.net.au is the email address. Thanks to our producers, Anita Barrow, Shane Anderson, and supervising producer, Kylie Gray. See you next time, Waleed.
You too, Hamish.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.